boys and girls. This is your old pal, Stinky Whistleteeth.
Finally made our way down to the studio. This is Bathrobes Pier Robert Norris. Only 7 minutes late on May 24th, 1996. You're tuned to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, the alternative to the alternative. It's Friday, and this is Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides is civil rights in Santa Cruz, particularly for poor people, but we kind of range around. We are going to go up to Eureka today, we're going to go to San Francisco, and we're going to deal with the main event on our plate, the proposed preliminary injunction against the homeless at City Hall. First, a little from the San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Bienvenidos compañeros, les venimos a cantar de mi pueblo tan bonito, ubicado cerca de mar. Una tierra milagrosa que parece un jardín, con sus pájaros y flores, mi país de San Martín. Amigos, we bid you welcome as we sing to you our song of a land that bathed in rivers and is warm beneath the sun. Mother Earth in all her richness beneath the fields of yellow grain, but her magic shows most clearly in the sweetness of the day.
But within this garden paradise, a volcanic fire grows. As the pressure to control it mounts, it threatens to explode.
This mighty power of nature, when unleashed, is bound to win. So grab a seat and you can watch the fireworks begin.
That was the Mime Troupe from about a decade ago. I think that's Last Waltz in Chattatanango, if I'm not mistaken, which I may well be, because I don't have the album cover here, and it's a tape of a record. We're going to be hearing periodic selections from Last Waltz at Chattatanango, or maybe it's Last Tango in Huantatanango, or it's... Anyway, it's a satire that the San Francisco Mime Troupe did about a decade ago around U.S. intervention abroad. Right now, concerned with Santa Cruz intervention in Santa Cruz against the rights of people to sleep at night. And we're going to do a few interviews on that subject. In fact, we'll start at City Hall a week or two ago with an interview.
We're talking to... My name's Alan.
And Alan, you're a newcomer here to the City Hall Sleepout. You were here last night?
Yeah, I was here last night and the night before.
And what did you notice here?
What do you mean? What
in terms of the police. Was there an encounter with the police?
Yeah, mainly Devon spoke to the police, you know. But,
did you get a ticket?
I got a ticket, but, you know.
I was too busy harassing them to count how many people was getting tickets.
How many did you count, Alex? I'm sorry.
Five tickets.
Yeah, what tickets, Alan, do you remember?
It was me, it was Devin, Sunshine, Mooncat, and one other dude.
Robert Fleury, was he here?
I don't know his name.
So there were a total of five tickets. How many cops came?
Three.
And do you know who they were? Sergeant Clark among them?
No, I just know that there's three cops. They all got the names on the tickets. You know?
Did they take any bedding or blankets?
No, they didn't.
And did they make any, were they polite, were they rude, were they friendly, what was their strategy?
Well, to me, they were being kind of like sarcastic, like sort of like, you know, like one of them was, you know, kind of made it seem like it was a joke what we were doing, you know, like it was kind of thing.
Okay.
Because, you know, like, one acted like he never even heard of this. What's this, you know? And people told me he'd been here several times and ticketed people every time. He act like, you know, like he never heard of it before, and then he started writing
about
up tickets.
About what time did he show up?
5:45.
So, this was, we're talking Friday morning, May 10th here, and I guess the ticketing continues at City Hall. 5:45?
Yeah. Was this?
About,
was that well of the sleep when we were here?
About 5.
Santa Cruz here is covering the end of the meeting here at the Free Radio Santa Cruz.
We've done a couple of harassments, so I'll let everybody.
Whoops, we ran into another tape there. Sorry for the ancient tapes. We're kind of rushed in the mornings. We sometimes give you early interviews. Here, however, is an up-to-the-date, up-to-the-moment, timely interview with a man from Eureka whom we've never spoken to before, Michael O'Toole, a homeless activist in Eureka. I haven't had much experience with Michael, so I can neither vouch for him nor should I criticize him. He talks about harassment of the homeless in Eureka. So let's fade away from Santa Cruz for a moment and pick up on what's happening up there. When we can, that is. We should be tuning in momentarily.
It's May 23rd, and I'm on the line with Michael O'Toole, formerly of Sacramento, now in Eureka. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
And you're working with, what, the Civil Rights for Poor People in Humboldt County?
Right. I run a civil rights organization called Indigent Services Incorporated.
Dinners and Services?
Indigent.
Indigent Services, I'm sorry. And how long has this organization been in existence?
About a year now.
And what have you been up to?
Basically, we've done encampments and demonstrations to bring attention to the plight of the homeless here and the fact that the police and other officials here have sent a definite message out to the homeless and low-income community that they're not welcomed in this community. They bring down the tourism and they scare off tourists, and it's just not economically sound to have homeless people in Humboldt County.
Mm-hmm.
They've literally been picked up and took to the edge of town and told if they come back, they'll be arrested. I was personally told by the chief of police here that the best thing I could do is to pack up and go back to Sacramento because civil rights activists aren't needed here, that they know what to do here and they're doing it.
I see. That doesn't sound too friendly.
People shooting at us. We did an encampment for 2.5 weeks at a baseball diamond.
Where was that? When was this?
About 4 months ago.
And where was this?
It's called a place called Cooper's Gulch Recreational Facility in Eureka, California.
And what was the purpose of the encampment?
To bring attention that homeless people were being harassed, that their stuff was being destroyed, and that they needed a safe place to be.
How many people actually did this demonstration?
About 30 of them.
And were there arrests around this?
Yes.
And what happened to your group?
People who refer to themselves as vigilantes called the police department and complained about us, and the police department told them to do what they want, that the police have done everything they could, and shortly after that, we had people that were shot at. Two people were these vigilante people come up on them, one with a shotgun, one with a pistol, and told them that he had 5 minutes to vacate the area that he was in, or they would appropriately deal with him. And just stuff like that. That's the atmosphere that we're dealing with here.
And did you ever, did this vigilante activity successfully break up the encampment?
Yes.
So would you say then that the reason the encampment failed is not due to police action, but due to police tolerance of vigilante action?
Both.
And what about the jail sentences people suffered, if any?
It was really minor in that regard. They hit them mostly with fines, which they couldn't pay, and the fines just continued to escalate. Unable to pay a fine, they tack more on.
Now we're talking Eureka here?
Yes.
And I understand Eureka is also the, it's the Arcata up and further north that is the locus for a local Food Not Bombs group that has been the center of some, not national, but certainly state attention around the attempts of the judiciary to bar the serving of free food.
Correct. We have a thing going on here.
So you have another Eureka, you have a Eureka Food Not Bombs?
No, I mean for Humboldt County.
For Humboldt County.
The Food Not Bombs organization here is fighting a court battle concerning the right to feed people.
And they are still serving people up in Arcata every day?
From what I understand, I think they got an injunction to stop it or something. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Did Food Not Bombs provide you with any support during your encampment?
No.
Did you attempt to get support at that point?
No. At that point, we were the only group we were getting support from was the Hope Coalition.
The Hope Coalition?
Yeah.
And what is that group?
It's a group that sprang from another organization called Citizens for Social Response,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a, I guess the best way I could say it, similar to the people that you have in Berkeley, that they're kind of hippie-ish, that stand out and say, hey, these things are unjust.
Mm-hmm.
And they just lobby against unjust behavior of authority.
Any ACLU assistance up there?
No, none whatsoever. The closest thing we have is a branch of legal services that has been cut back. They're down to like 4 people. They're open 3 days a week.
And did legal services help you at all in your attempt to maintain this encampment?
No, they couldn't. It wasn't politically, you know, I hate to say this, it wasn't politically
correct. Did now you say this happened in January and February?
Yeah.
And what was your objective with this encampment?
We just wanted a safe, at that time we just wanted a safe place for homeless people to be, because they were being harassed, their property was being destroyed. The police were actually telling them that they were not going to be here. They would arrest them, they would destroy their stuff, they would intimidate them to the point that they would leave.
And was there any change in police practice as a consequence of this encampment, in spite of the fact that it was, what you say, destroyed by vigilantes? No? No change?
Not whatsoever.
So, how many homeless people do you estimate you have in Eureka?
Between 1,500 and 2,000.
And you have specific ordinances that make it illegal to sleep at night in public?
It's ordinance that says it's illegal to sleep anytime, anywhere, for any purpose.
Really? And are the police arresting people for sleeping?
Yeah.
And what's the standard fine for that kind of behavior?
Something like $80 first time.
Mm-hmm. Second time?
It escalates. I'm not sure what the escalation is. And the funny thing about it, how they do it here, mm-hmm. is they make it a misdemeanor so you can't fight it.
Meaning?
You can't get a public defender.
Oh, you mean an infraction. They make it an infraction.
Right, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
We asked to have them all moved up. We had like 4 of us that were arrested at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
We asked for all of them to be raised to...
in misdemeanors.
Right, and they wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew if they did, that would give us the ability to take it to court, lose, and then take it to a higher court.
Mm-hmm. So you've been staying in touch with a lot of these matters on the internet, it seems, and you ran across some email or some news group postings which mentioned Santa Cruz and the problems we're having down here.
Right.
And what was your reaction when you, what have you read about this?
Well, basically, I can tell you what I think it was from you.
Oh, really? Because I haven't posted anything. My modem isn't working. Maybe somebody grabbed something of mine and put it on the internet.
I'm bringing it up. Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a webpage that I do. I have homeless people that... I encourage homeless people to publish things on my webpage,
mm-hmm.
as their point of view of what's going on.
Right.
And I'm kind of, my organization, what we're doing is we're trying to get the homeless themselves an avenue to speak out.
Right.
And it's totally controlled by homeless people. It gives them a nonprofit that they can apply for funds with.
Mm-hmm.
And they have validity in the fact that they are now
And what's the name of this group?
Indigent Services Incorporated.
Huh. And are you a nonprofit?
Yes. California.
Wow. Congratulations. So how do we get to your webpage for those internet buffs?
http://www.northcoast.com/KillDayOpenKit.
Okay. For anybody who's listening, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM down here in Santa Cruz. And if you didn't catch that email address and you would like to get a copy of it, give me a call at 408-423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I'll get you Michael O'Toole's address, his email address, so you can, and his, at least this, say again?
This, email came from you.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's fine. I'm glad that my flyers are getting out. As I said, I haven't filed anything. Maybe somebody else is translating them and filing them, which is good. I've had problems with the modem for quite a while.
We're about to have something hit the fan tomorrow when the city...
Actually, that was yesterday.
Yes.
Yesterday we had the city tried to get a TRO to close down an 84-day-old, not encampment, but vigil, which they claimed was an encampment at City Hall, where we've been 24 hours a day protesting the city's anti-homeless sleeping ban, which prohibits sleeping between 11 and 8:30 at night on public and private property, with very few exceptions. Fenced in side yards and backyards are exceptions. And, you know, there's 500 to 1,500 homeless people in Santa Cruz, and a law that makes it illegal to sleep. So you have, you know, a clear contradiction, basic violation of constitutional rights. And we've talked for years about some kind of seeking some kind of injunction ourselves, as, for example, they did in Miami under the Pottinger decision to...
Right, that's what we've been trying to work with, is Pottinger.
And do you have an attorneys yourself, Michael, who are ready to take a case in Eureka?
Just me. Nobody else will touch it.
Now, you're a lawyer?
No, I'm paralegal. That's the problem.
Uh-huh.
So the problem with us is we're so remote. We're so rural. We don't qualify for funding. We don't have anybody that can help us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people down in the Bay Area and stuff say, well, we can't help you because, you know, we're dealing with stuff in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. You might try contacting Arcata Food Not Bombs, not because they have, you know, a wealth of lawyers, but because they have gotten a certain amount of attention in the alternate community and media, and then because they have got some lawyers who are helping them with their case. And I think it would be productive for you guys to kind of, cross-fertilize each other, so to speak. They might be willing to support your event, at least in terms of, say, a feeding or two, and you might be able to give some support to their event, their struggle, because I'm sure you support the right to share free
yes,
food.
Of course. I think anybody should be allowed to give anybody food.
Do you have their number up there and so forth? Okay.
Something else I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get a hold of people in Sacramento to do another demo at the Capitol.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's about time that... Time for something like that to happen.
Yeah, it should be mentioned for those who don't know, and I guess that's probably everybody listening down here, that I guess the two of us first met at the California Homeless and Housing Coalition, or California Homeless Network, I'm not sure what it was called, meeting. They have this April annual meeting in Sacramento where the sort of these
housing
poverty pimps all get together and hold seminars and so forth. But they're also, you know, token homeless people are invited. And I guess the year we got together, there's actual organizing by the Coalition on Homelessness from San Francisco, and I guess Santa Barbara Homeless Coalition, and folks in other cities to actually do a sort of a sleep-in, camp-in to support the Union of the Homeless in Sacramento, which was then forming. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, it wasn't just for Sacramento. It was for all homeless in California.
Right. But I know that we were particularly concerned about the harassment of homeless in Sacramento, and they were harassing them along the riverbeds, and the Sacramento Homeless had formed a union. Whatever happened to the Union of the Homeless in Sacramento? It died. Yeah, well, And you guys are still holding regular meetings? The Indigent, give me the name of your group again.
Indigent Services Incorporated.
Indigent Services Incorporated?
Yeah, we're doing our best.
How many people are part of your group?
We have an ongoing, fluctuating group of homeless people, which range from like 100 to 110.
Mm-hmm.
But we have like 6 people on our board that are all homeless.
And do you guys meet like once a week? What kind of activities do you do?
Well, we don't do any activities, basically. You mean like demonstrations and stuff like that?
Yeah.
So basically, we backed off that because it wasn't doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the problems we have here. They can literally ignore us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of Reuven Botello.
I'm not sure. Who is that?
Dr. Reuven Botello. He's a homeless advocate up here that has done hunger strikes and all sorts of other things on behalf of the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
But he did an encampment at City Hall, and they said, fine, stay there. We don't care.
Huh.
And no homeless people came, and it ended up where Reuven was on a 51-day hunger. He was on 51 days of a hunger strike,
mm-hmm.
and he just couldn't take it anymore. Nobody was even acknowledging what was going on.
Wow. This is before your organization had formed. When did this hunger strike happen?
Yeah, it was, in fact, immediately after that, we formed Indigent Services.
I see. So this is what, in December he had his hunger strike?
Right.
What about Navarro Beach? Is that south of you?
Yeah, Navarro Beach, is that a dead issue now?
I think so, but for a couple of years, people probably don't know what that is who are listening. Navarro Beach was a beach that actually got some funding from the state as a campground for homeless people for, what, about a year or two?
Right, it was the last free beach on the west coast.
And that was, is that Mendocino County or Humboldt County?
Mendocino.
So sort of south of you.
In fact, I went up and fought on their behalf for like 2.5 weeks, so all the legal services could afford to let me go.
And what year was that?
It was like 2 years ago.
Uh-huh. And what happened to Navarro Beach?
Well, from what I understand, they lost.
Hmm. And so they've all been dispersed?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And now it's one of those you can stay 7 days and then you have to leave for a month.
We have a similar situation down here. You probably read about it in the papers, where there was a homeless tried to use some of the state beaches, and still are, in fact, but there was actually a city-funded effort to help homeless people use the state beaches for a period of time and kind of rotate from one campground to another. In a way, well, you know, it's nice because state beaches are better, more sanitary, more hot water, more friendlier places than homeless encampments. And another way was the city's declining to deal with the shelter crisis here in Santa Cruz and sending the problem out of town. So, is there any message you have, Michael, for the Santa Cruz community here concerned with the homeless, the rights of homeless people, or for homeless people themselves here?
As far as people with for rights with for homeless people, keep fighting for them because they need them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're getting less and less people that are willing to fight for us.
Right.
And for the homeless themselves, don't give up because there is a solution out there, and we will win in the end. I mean, we have the right to be here. We are human beings. We're American citizens, and we have the right to be here. And eventually, the government will acknowledge that.
So, if you want to come down to actually see what's happening with us. The next date for the injunction, we have the preliminary injunction hearing is May 31st at 1 o'clock on Friday in Department 8, in case you're interested. I believe it's 1 o'clock on Friday. I hope I'm not giving you the wrong time. I have to double check that. We had a victory. The city tried to have this injunction, the TRO, thrown together to have us all dispersed. And I should say the people at the encampment, I haven't been at the encampment myself, I've been writing about it and speaking on its behalf. But it's not really an encampment, as I said before. It's fundamentally a vigil where people, a few people do sleep there at night, but mostly it's a series of protest signs where people are there during the day petitioning and so forth. So it's more of a free speech activity than any kind of a set of alternate shelter quarters, so to speak, or even an outdoor encampment. But, you know, you can certainly, it's happening every night at City Hall, every day and night. It's a 24-hour vigil. If anybody wants to come down from Eureka or thereabouts, they're welcome, and share their information and experience of what's going on here and what's going on up there. And we can perhaps do the same for you, and perhaps your plans to try to spark some kind of activity in Sacramento, we can discuss as well. I know that Bob Hansen and Colin Atherton from Santa Barbara came up and began picketing in Santa Cruz against the city's sleeping ban, urging people to boycott Pacific Avenue just last week. So there is increasing cross-interaction between homeless communities in different cities.
That's what I'm saying. It's a time right now that I don't think we need a homeless pimp convention to do an encampment.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, look, forgive me, I'm sounding a little tired, but I hope that some of your enthusiasm and your determination has come through. And I have a twice a week radio show. It's called Bathropes, Pierre's Broadsides. It's from 10 to 12 on our little FM underground radio station, 96.3 FM. And if you want to send me any further information, Michael, you can. Just call this phone number, 408-423-4833.
And if you would like to get any information to me, or if anybody would like to get any, they can send it via my email.
And your email is?
OpusKin@northcoast.com.
Spell that out.
OpusKin
mm-hmm.
at northcoast.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, send me any recent stuff you've done on the email, and even though I haven't got my modem operating, I can use somebody else's because I have an account.
Uh-huh.
And my address is norse@netcom.com. norse@netcom.com. And I want to thank you, Michael. Anything else you want to say or information you want to give?
No, just keep up the fight.
All right. You too.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that was civil rights activist Michael O'Toole up in Eureka describing the situation with an encampment that he worked with 2 months ago that was apparently busted up by vigilantes with the collusion of the police. Interesting. We have had a few vigilante incidents down here, but
not a lot.
Not a lot, so nothing in terms of shootings, which apparently he referred to briefly. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, as you just heard, 96.3 FM. We don't have a call-in line yet. We're at temporary quarters here, kind of in motion, so to speak. And we hope to improve facilities as soon as we can, but hey, that'll be as soon as we get the wherewithal to do it and the places to locate to, assuming, of course, that Claudia Wilkins doesn't just close us down with a bad decision against Free Radio Berkeley, which may be coming down the pike. We're not sure. We have no new information on that case. About a month and a half ago, Free Radio Berkeley went into court to argue that its station had free speech rights on the air, and no injunction was granted against them that was sought by the Federal Communications Commission, which apparently believes in free speech for the rich and costly radios for the rest of us. I don't know. Whatever. Whatever. So we are here, and if you want to get in touch and put something on the air, you can give me a call at 423-4833. I haven't been looking for guests at Taco Bell, but if you think you want to be on the air, I will start looking again. Give me a call again at 423-4833. Leave a message on the line, and you can show up in the studio and be a guest on the show. If you have something to say about the situation outdoors in Santa Cruz as an urban nomad person or homeless or houseless or roofless person, that's your option. Do so if you like. A couple of announcements here. We have a forum coming up on the death penalty and political prisoners in the USA featuring the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. You've heard that name before. It's Saturday, June 1st, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Kresge Town Hall. Speakers include Leonard Weinglass, there's a famous attorney, who's involved with the Chicago 8, chief counsel for Mumia, Ramona Africa, there's another famous name. She was the survivor of the MOVE bombing. That's where the Philadelphia police blew up a house full of black people in Philadelphia. They had to destroy the people in order to save them, including lots of kids, back in 1982 or so. And now the MOVE people are suing, the MOVE survivors are suing the city for that action. I wish I could hear some more updates on that. And if you have any updates, any listeners, please give me a call at 423-4833. Record a little update for us, and we'll play it on the next show. Also speaking at this June 1st, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. all-day free forum, going to be David Anthony, professor at the History Board, Noel Hanrahan, writer of Equal Justice USA, Craig Haney, UCSC professor on the Psychology Board, George Martin of the California American Indian Movement, and others. This is a free event, and the topics are not only going to include Mumia Abu-Jamal, currently on death row in Pennsylvania, but also racism and imprisonment, women in prison, prisoners' rights. So look into that, June 1st, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The flyer was actually given to me by Laura Corradi. Laura is also doing a debate, or I should say a forum, involving myself, Mayor Michael Rotkin, Lighthouse Linda LeMaster, Beggarbacker Becky Johnson, and I guess Karen Gillette. I used to call her Cupcake Queen Karen back in the hostel days. She's the director of the homeless QC, Karen, I called her, Queen of the Cupcakes. But she's been much more respectful of the rights of protesters since then. I wish she was a bit more outspoken on rights of people around the sleeping ban, but I think she does have a fundamental sympathy for overturning that onerous law. All we have to do is translate that into effective action, because her Homeless Community Resource Center has real pull, I think, in the city, and if they came out publicly in favor of that kind of a change, they could have real impact on the city council. I do believe that. She's going to be on that show, the debate with the discussion with Rotkin on homeless issues. And finally, I guess they're trying to get Kimberly Carter of the Above the Line Community Consortium. This is for a June 3rd, 2 p.m. free radio show, which will be pre-recorded since the studio facilities here do leave something to be desired. They tend to eat up tapes and lock out people, but that's another story. You can take that up with Phil Free and Bob Duran, but I won't rag on them any further at the moment. Also coming down the pike is a forum on police abuse. Public forum and multimedia presentation on the increased repression by San Francisco police since Willie Brown became mayor. The Economic Summit, I'm reading from a flyer here, helped show that the new mayor supports the interests of downtown business at the expense of the people in the neighborhoods. Mayor Brown has been silent about the increase in police repression. The San Francisco Police Department seems to be a taxpayer-financed private army whose job is to defend the interests of corporations like Bank of America, Bechtel, Pacific Gas and Electric, and The Gap by suppressing the rights of the community. The police department's campaign of terror against the homeless and poor, youth, people of color, immigrants, gays, lesbians, and political activists is designed to reduce the tax burden on big business and help maximize corporate profits. You are invited to ask the police department what they intend to do to change their priorities. Add your testimony to the Amnesty International and the UN Human Rights Commission investigations on police repression in San Francisco. We will be discussing the following topics: the increase arrests of people for the crime of being homeless from 1,200 in the first 2 months of 1995 to over 2,300 arrests in January and February of 1996. There were 912 such citations in March. The use of loitering with intent laws as a way to move poor people out of sight. Increased police repression against political activists at protests, such as the arrest of 130 people on March 3rd, police attacks on tenant activists in public housing, and police interference with literature tables and button vendors. The increase in police violence against youth, people of color, and the, quote, in-custody death syndrome. San Francisco Police Department repression against immigrants, day workers, and people trying to make a living. That's Friday. Here comes the date you've all been waiting for, folks. Sorry I took so long. Friday, May 31st, 1996, same day our injunction hits the courts, I'm afraid, 6 p.m. I guess you can go to the injunction hearing in the morning or afternoon. I'm not quite sure when it is. I should know, and I'll announce it on the next show. Right now I'm a little confused on that. At 6 p.m. in San Francisco, Friday, May 31st, at New College, 777 Valencia Street, is this public forum on increased repression and workshops as to what to do about it. There's a lot of interesting information around this. There's in fact, I have a flyer I'm going to be distributing widely from San Francisco. And here's a little more description. On March 3rd, 1996, 130 marchers were arrested exercising their First Amendment rights in a peaceful demonstration against police violence. Rounding up and arresting an entire nonviolent demonstration clearly indicates that police policies have not changed under the new administration. And these arrests are not the only outrages. Since the inauguration in January, that's the inauguration of Mayor Slick Willie Brown, the following injustices have taken place in San Francisco. 2,300 matrix arrests of the homeless in January and February, 1,000 more arrests than during the same months in 1995. Food Not Bombs arrests for sharing free food and literature in March. Male police officers strip-searched a young woman at Juvenile Hall in February. Police have obtained two helicopters from the Defense Department for use in our neighborhoods. Increased arrests of sex workers. I wish we had had someone, by the way, last night at Kresge College. And if anybody wants to do a report on what happened up there here at, down in Santa Cruz, there was a large forum on sex workers. Give me a call at 423-HUFF. Continuing this flyer, police sweeps in every poor neighborhood, including Haight Street, the Mission, the Western Addition, Bayview, Hunters Point, the Excelsior, and the Tenderloin, and the pepper spray murder of Mark Garcia. After the March 3rd mass arrests, the San Francisco Police Department and the District Attorney's Office called for a meeting with representatives of the activist community to, quote, set ground rules for protest. But unfortunately, the police have ignored even their own ground rules, such as crowd control manual and the general orders governing spying on political groups. And there's a lot more here, and I hope you can get a copy of this flyer. You might check the City Hall sleepers protest. I'm going to leave some copies of the flyer there. And again, this meeting, to be a part of this forum, show up at 6 o'clock at New College in San Francisco, 777 Valencia Street, on Friday, May 31st at 6 o'clock. So, well, let's have a little musical break. It's, you've been hearing me for a while. Now hear the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Now hear this.
Ay va, ay va mi vida. once I loved him so. Like doves, my dreams had flown away, left me here alone. I dream of dancing in the city with a husband by my side. But that was ago. How my dreams have died. Oh, my dreams have died.
Pobre Rufina, in a river of self-pity. Mia mujer, mira, open your eyes. Outside your window,
the Mime Troupe. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And coming up next, we have an interview with attorney David Beauvais of Berkeley, who was one of three attorneys. There are actually more who showed up in court, but they were the three who carried the case. Volunteer attorneys, real hard to find in Santa Cruz, by the way, for poor people, who spoke out to defend City Hall sleepers, people who are trying to get the community and the city council to become aware of what is going on in this community with respect to police abuse against poor people and the homeless, and institutionalized police abuse. We're not talking about rogue cops. We're talking about laws that make it criminal to sleep at night. Laws that make it criminal for people under a certain income level to sleep at night. People who have to sleep outside, who have to sleep in their vehicles, who are essentially made criminals after 11 o'clock at night, under a, not a state ordinance, not a Newt Gingrich ordinance, not a Pete Wilson ordinance, no, not even a Board of Supervisors ordinance where there's a right-wing majority now. No, we're talking a city council ordinance where the city council progressives have a 6-to-1 majority. That's the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban. That's the law that, because the city council doesn't even want to hear the protest there, they have gone to court to bar protesters. They have gone to court to make sure that even people wanting to hold up signs at night at City Hall will be doing so only under threat of up to 5 days in jail. No, I've heard it's even more than that. Up to 6 months in jail is what I'm told by this attorney. And this is one of the guys, actually there are two men and one woman, who went to court to help support the City Hall sleepers, to argue their rights in court. That's Kate Wells, our local attorney, David Beauvais, and Larry Hildes. And let's hear what David Beauvais has to say about that limited victory that the City Hall sleepers won yesterday. Actually, they won it on Wednesday. The victory where they'll be allowed to continue to... They'll still be arrested at City Hall. They'll still be given $162 tickets. They'll still be taken to jail and face up to 6 months in jail if they sleep twice within 48 hours. None of those things have changed. But they will be able to fight those things out in court along a legal process rather than be told by a judge as a coup, as a fiat, as just his word, his royal decree, that if they do that, they'll simply be put in jail without essentially any kind of real trial. The they'll be tried for contempt of court, when the only issue is, did they violate a court order, a lawful court order? And I went through that whole process myself up in San Francisco. I was arrested for serving free food, and I was sentenced to 2 months in jail, in spite of a jury trial, because the issues don't come out at a jury trial. The jurors become intimidated. They start acting like they're working on an arithmetic problem rather than a human problem, and they do their part as cogs in the machine instead of recognizing the wider dimensions and understanding their wider rights in this issue. So, here's David Beauvais of Berkeley.
I'm on a line to attorney David Beauvais of Berkeley, who came down all the way from Berkeley to help the City Hall sleep out, which was threatened with a temporary restraining order. What was that threat, David, and what violations of constitutional rights did the defendants face that you were defending them against? I guess it was on Wednesday before Judge Stevens.
Right. The city attorney came into court seeking a temporary restraining order to ban outright a protest of about 4 to 6 people on City Hall property between 10 p.m. and 8 a.m. The reason that they said that they were trying to ban this demonstration is that the people there were leaving food and littering, drawing rats to City Hall property, and that they were defecating and urinating on the property.
Mm-hmm. And I guess they were also seeking to get to eliminate signs there, and also they claimed that people were illegally sleeping on the City Hall.
Right. As I understand it, a number of sleeping tickets have been given out.
190, as I understand it.
Right, by the police there. And when they came into court seeking their injunction, their argument was that the sleeping tickets were ineffective in getting people to stay awake.
Well, they need to be trained, obviously. These homeless people are, inveterate criminals. This happened at what's called an ex parte hearing, when folks were sort of, some people were given a little notice that, not even personally served or anything, but told that there was this hearing happening. And I know Sergeant Andy Crane went through the vigil and gave it to a number of the protesters. And protesters were really wondering if they were going to find themselves simply in jail. What would have been the consequences had this temporary restraining order been granted, and had people decided to remain after 10 o'clock at night, let's say the night after the order had been granted?
The order would drastically change the situation, because instead of simply being cited on what is an infraction ticket in most instances, people would now have faced up to 6 months in jail for violation of the restraining order, because it could be prosecuted as a criminal contempt action.
Something that I am, and you are both, very familiar with, because in San Francisco, that's exactly what happened to me when I served free food with Food Not Bombs in 1993, and indeed was convicted of misdemeanor, given 2 months in jail, and I'm currently hoping that we can get that sentence modified on June 7th when we return to court in San Francisco at 1 o'clock at 850 Bryant Street in Department 14, I think it is.
It's exactly the same situation. The same type of case.
And is this becoming a popular tactic by police departments and city politicians to get rid of homeless protests? Have you heard of this happening elsewhere?
Yes, it has happened elsewhere. And where it has been used the most is in some drug cases, and also in gang-related cases. A number of jurisdictions have enacted laws that essentially criminalize people that appear to be in gangs. And many times cities will seek injunctions under these laws in order to purportedly break up gang activity. So the same sorts of devices are used in the general criminal law in certain areas, but it's also been extended to the homeless now, and to people who are seeking to protest on homeless issues.
Mm-hmm. So you've kind of rounded up some defenses for dealing with this issue, and apparently you were successful, because the only thing that Judge Stevens did rule, as I understand it, was that people could not defecate and urinate on the City Hall grounds, which seems to be a reasonable concern, although, ironically, and I have to say as advocate for people in this situation, since there are no bathrooms open at night, it's really very unrealistic of the city to expect people to, carry their own catheters and doggy bags. I'm not quite sure what the city expects.
I understand what you're saying. And one of the things that we're going to suggest to the court is that the city could open that bathroom, which would, obviously...
The bathroom at City Hall right next to the city council chamber.
Which would obviously minimize... The health problems or potential health problems.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a disputed issue about whether people have actually done that, and if it has happened, whether it's been that often.
And who it was. Being arrested by the police regularly tends to deter other homeless people who would otherwise, let's say, be camping there quite regularly
right.
from being there because they don't want to be arrested.
Right.
Although, in fact, there is such a shelter emergency in Santa Cruz with 500 to 1,500 people without shelter and with no legal place to sleep. And such a draconian law enforced, the city's anti-homeless sleeping ban, which actually bars the act of sleeping after 11 o'clock at night, that indeed, since all places are equally illegal, there's no reason to for one place to be chosen over any other, except that one possibly has more foliage to hide in and is less likely to be patrolled by police.
Right. Well, I'm also interested in evidence that appears to be developing that the city is targeting demonstrators or protesters for sleeping in violation of the sleeping ban, but that other people in other areas are left unmolested
for
the same conduct, which means that they're using the sleeping ban, they're enforcing it discriminatorily in order to chill out the expression of First Amendment rights. This raises another issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you should propose this, because that's exactly what Michael Rotkin said to me in several interviews and debates, which he said that we don't bother the good homeless, the vast majority of the homeless people, they sleep where, whenever they want, but he actually said he had been to the camps of homeless people in the Poganip, and they don't cause any trouble if they're out of sight and out of the way and don't make a mess, but it's protesters who want to be arrested, quote unquote, this is his perception of the protest at City Hall, and of course that's not the protesters' perception, because they're not there to be arrested, as I understand it, they're there to change the law and to force the city to consider a real, rational, and humane alternatives to the current situation. But Rotkin himself has stated that it's only the protesters who get arrested, and that's because they want to be arrested. Other people are not arrested. Other homeless people are not arrested. And so you may have, if I can find those tapes for you, some substantial documentation for your, at least in terms of the mayor's statement. So he is not the executive officer in our city. He describes himself as being only one council member. It's the city manager who supposedly has the power in Santa Cruz.
Well, I think when the mayor speaks, the mayor is speaking on behalf of the city, and I don't think that he can minimize that function. He holds himself out as the mayor, and he is the one that's charged with, along with other city council members, the making of the policy of the city of Santa Cruz. And the city council cannot duck responsibility by claiming that it's up to the city manager and they don't have the power, because I thoroughly reject that notion. The city council is the one that initiated the lawsuit, not the city manager.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, I believe it was Michael Rotkin who probably had a large share in initiating the vote at city council. He's been behind a number of other, what I consider, anti-homeless projects. For instance, he wanted to fence off the Ford's parking lot, which is at Friendship Corner, Cathcart and Pacific, where there's a regular meal for homeless people every night, actually for homeless in the transient community, done by two local groups, Feed the People and Food Not Bombs. And that vacant parking lot area, which has been sort of a public gathering spot since the earthquake, has recently been purchased by a developer and has now actually been fenced off by private sources. But at the time when the mayor attempted to have this done, he wanted to spend public funding to fence off usable parking areas simply because he felt that it would cut down on the hippie traffic in that area. That was actually the initial out front statements that were made by the downtown commission who pushed this proposal, which originally came from the police department. And Rodkin essentially was on that bandwagon, and he was voted down by city council, strangely enough. We were very pleased. It was a 4-3 vote, or maybe a 5-2 vote. And unfortunately, there are supposed to be 3 votes in city council in favor of ending the sleeping ban, Catherine Byers, Celia Scott, and Scott Kennedy. But as you know, when the injunction against the city hall sleepers was voted a week ago, that they asked the city attorney to drop this temporary restraining order, 5 council members in closed litigation session voted secretly for it. And that seems to show there really is a, I don't know if we'd call it a change of heart or just increasing indifference, insensitivity, and obliviousness to the needs of poor people in the community, and I believe the problem, if they don't like the message, the best thing to do is to bury the messenger, or at least to drive those any particular messengers away from City Hall. So in Berkeley, I take it you have similar ordinances that the city is enforcing to try to drive the homeless away. I thought you had a Proposition O which narrowly passed a vote after activists were successful in wrenching it from the city council and forcing it to be placed on the ballot. That's an anti-homeless don't sit on the sidewalk law, a series of anti-panhandling laws wrapped up with a couple of social service carrots that were...
Well, the Measure O right now is on hold, at least as to most of its provisions.
Mm-hmm. You actually successfully got an injunction against that in federal court, right?
Yes. And that action is now in the Ninth Circuit, and they haven't ruled yet.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any predictions on that case?
No, I don't make predictions like that.
Mm-hmm.
There is a troubling case that's come down in the Ninth Circuit out of Seattle involving
another sit-down law,
panhandling, and sitting down, and that may cause problems for the Berkeley case, but it's difficult to know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the law here is so new that there isn't a lot of precedent. There's a lot of room for creativity in this area.
Now, indeed, I understand some of the campers are not merely concerned with fighting the city's concocted injunction. I kind of describe it as... dirty rats and lying dogs is the flyer that I'm getting ready to write, which talks about this Rodkin's sudden concern with rats at City Hall. Of course, we know where the rats are, but the concern about, poo-poo and pee-pee on the grounds when he could deal with that, simply passing a key on for use of the bathrooms at night by the protesters. It's obviously a subterfuge for eliminating the protest. However, his injunction is one thing, and you are volunteering your time along with your colleague Larry Hildes to come down and assist Kate Wells. Kate Wells, I guess you had a couple of ACLU attorneys hanging out in court on Wednesday. How did they do?
Yes, the ACLU has is going to request to come into the case as a friend of the court.
Mm-hmm. In order to raise what kind of issues?
As a friend of the court, the ACLU has input into the legal issues that surround the case and can do their own analysis of the questions presented and present that to the court and argue about it. So we're very happy to have
ACLU
the ACLU involvement in this case.
Well, that's good. For me, the ACLU has always been a mixed bag. I mean, certainly in Northern California, up further north and in Berkeley, of course, the ACLU was instrumental in helping to get your injunction against Proposition O, injunction in this case being a positive thing for the homeless. And that's always good news. Here in Santa Cruz, the ACLU did do some work in fighting the sitting ordinance in 1994 and spoke against it when it came to city council. But generally, they have been silent or and uninterested in, around the issue of the sleeping ban historically here in Santa Cruz. And if we can see a change in that position, that would be nice, although I think it's actually taken you as an out-of-town catalyst to... And you volunteering your time and money and, well, not your money, but you certainly, you know, you're coming down here and you are volunteering your money because your time is your money, I'm sure. And the second issue that I guess was one of the reasons that your colleague Larry Hildes was called was to, in hopes of getting some kind of federal injunction against the city sleeping ban, even though such an attempt, has failed at a state level when it was tried in Santa Ana. Do you have any comments on that effort?
Well, the Santa Ana situation is different because the... I don't want to go into the minutiae of this too much because I think it's just going to bore people. Mm-hmm. But there was an attack made on a similar camping ordinance that Santa Ana had developed, and there was evidence in that case that the city had an express policy of driving the homeless out of town. They made no bones about it.
Mm-hmm.
But when the case came up to the Supreme Court, after the Court of Appeal said that the camping ban was unconstitutional because it violated a number of federal civil rights, and at the baseline of the Court of Appeal's analysis was Santa Ana has insufficient shelter space for the number of homeless people who reside there, and people were forced to live in the street, and having a camping ban was inconsistent with the rights of these people who, as a right to travel, had a right to remain in Santa Ana. So the Court of Appeal ruled in favor of the homeless parties in that case.
That was the right to travel, the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment, and the right to equal protection of the laws. Right?
Exactly. Now, when the case got to the California Supreme Court, the court said, look, you didn't really raise the issue of the camping ban being applied in a manner to discriminate against homeless people or to drive them out of town. What you really did was you attacked the language of the ordinance on its face, and we can't say that on the face of the ordinance it was unconstitutional. So you didn't make an attack that was being discriminatorily enforced. We are going to make that attack, so that case doesn't apply.
So here in Santa Cruz...
Hold on one second.
Sure. Let me just thank you, David Beauvais, for talking with us. I realize it's a busy time for you. Let's hope we can get some updates in the future.
Okay, take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
And that was indeed Attorney David Beauvais from Berkeley, who's defending me up in San Francisco on the case of contempt of court for serving free food, and is involved in defending the City Hall sleepers. At least he's made one appearance on their behalf at the temporary restraining order sought by Assistant City Attorney Condotti, I guess the whole city attorney, sought by the city to drive away the bearers of bad news that the city is giving lots of money to poverty pimps and ignoring the basic problems of a campground, or at least an alteration in the city's sleeping ban law so people are not criminals after dark, or maybe both. Who knows? Let's get really extravagant and luxurious here and provide even more wonderful social services, like the social service of not being arrested after 11 o'clock at night. Media coverage around this has been front page, but... initially horrible, and recently better, but still inaccurate. The most recent story was yesterday's story, Santa Cruz City Hall Campers Win Round in Court, by Karen Clark. And, you know, it's a little kind of three or four or five-column story, two columns on the front page. It's kind of small. And I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to read you, point out some of the inaccuracies for all of you who read the Santa Cruz Urinal, or the Sentinel, as they call it. The small band of homeless protesters who have camped at City Hall for 3 months won a skirmish in court Wednesday when a judge refused to grant a restraining order against them. Of course, they would deny, A, that they are small, and indeed, there are more than 40 names on the injunction, 45 names, and more than 190, 95 tickets have been issued. I guess you could say they're small, and at any time they're about no more than 10 people there. I suppose that's relatively small, but it's mighty. They've been there without stop, without breaking their vigil for that 85 days now? Yes, 85 days. It's not a camp, however. They have not been camping at City Hall. They've been coming to City Hall at night and vigiling, and some of them occasionally will lie down and sleep. They also have no legal place to sleep in Santa Cruz, so it's not like they're coming to, let's say, do an abortion protest or a protest against the execution of people at a state prison where they would lie down and go back to their beds. The very thing that they do is expressive conduct, because that kind of conduct is forbidden elsewhere, and it's an essential to human life. So it's an interesting double situation where the sleeping is also an act of free speech, but it's also an act of necessity, because there is no place legally for homeless people to sleep in Santa Cruz city limits, a fact admitted by the mayor himself in the April edition of the Mid-County Post. And I read about that at the time, and no doubt I'll bring that quote at a future point. City Council has sought the order as a tool to force protesters to obey all laws or suffer stiffer penalties than the hundreds of citations already handed out by police. Actually, that's not accurate. They're not seeking to have the protesters obey all laws. They're seeking to have them gone at night. That's not a law. In fact, it is legal to be at City Hall at night, but it would not be legal for the protesters if the preliminary injunction sought by the city is granted. Paragraph 3 of Karen Clark's story. City officials charged the protesters not only violated the camping ban that is the target of their demonstration, but also have harassed passersby, blocked paths, littered, and left human waste on the grounds. Well, camping ban. It's true that that law, 6.3, 6.010, is called the camping ban. But the protesters are not talking about the right to set up tents and roast weenies. They are talking about that provision in the camping ban, 6.3, 6.010, A, B, and C, which have to do, mainly A and B, sleeping and covering up blankets. And also C is being misused against people sleeping and or covering up with blankets. So they're not talking about camping. They're talking about sleeping. The Sentinel, however, likes to kind of rubber stamp the mayor and tail along after him when he continues to call it a camping ban protest. No, it's a sleeping ban protest. That's the issue. Sleeping, not camping. They wanted the judge, the city did, to ban the group from City Hall between 10 p.m. and 8 a.m. unless attending a city meeting, order them not to violate the camping ordinance, and force them to stop putting up signs in violation of city laws. What's not said here is the kind of penalties that the city is really seeking. They already have, as I've said earlier in the show, serious penalties for sleeping at night. $162 fine for the first ticket, and for the second one within 48 hours, it's up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. Isn't that enough, you would ask? Well, no, not for the city. They want to give people either 5 days in jail by contempt of court directly, or try them under a law which makes them culpable of violating a court order, which is up to 6 months in jail, which is what, for instance, I faced up in San Francisco and I'm now facing on June 7th for feeding up there. So the Sentinel is covering up the real penalties and the real issues here. Superior Court Judge Samuel Stevens told attorneys for both sides behind closed doors that he didn't see the urgency for granting the temporary restraining order on most of the conduct. True statement. He did, however, order protesters to immediately stop urinating and defecating on the City Hall grounds. And later on in the article, to their credit, or to her credit, Karen Clark mentions that Mayor Rotkin or the city authorities have refused to open up the restroom. Nor do they have any downtown restrooms that could be used by people at night. So people are apparently going to be trained in great self-control. You know, I suppose that's a way of porta-potty training or a potty training for the homeless. You know, that was one approach. Stevens said a May 31st hearing to air the issues in open court. The hearing will begin at 8:30 a.m. in Department 8 of Superior Court. Now, maybe that answers my prior question about when this hearing is, but frankly, if you read it in the Sentinel, go check your sources. That's my suggestion. They make so many errors. I read about city council meetings that aren't there. I read about an absence of city council meetings that are there. They're just not a good source. You might start there, but I'm hoping to get... I'll get accurate information to you next Monday on when the May 31st hearing is. 8:30 sounds right, but who can be sure at this point? At that time, Stevens could issue a preliminary injunction which would force protesters to obey all laws until the issue is settled in a full-blown trial with testimony from all sides. We're really happy the judge recognized the First Amendment aspects of this case, said David Beauvais, a Berkeley attorney who represented the homeless defendants.
The city is trying to keep people from seeking redress of grievances at their city hall, the Imperial Palace. It's true, the city is trying to do that. But it's also true that what the city is trying to do is bury the issue of the sleeping ban deep, so it is not a public issue. Because, as I said, half of this is not just people protesting at night or the right to First Amendment signs and things of that sort, which are important rights. But it's the fact that they cannot go to sleep anywhere without being arrested, so why not sleep at City Hall? Or at least it'll be seen, and the issue will be noted as an act of political protest. Outside the courtroom, City Councilwoman Catherine Byers, who cast one of two dissenting votes along with Councilwoman Celia Scott against pursuing the court action, said she was sorry the situation had gotten to this point. She's the constant hand-wringer, is Catherine, I'm afraid. But, well, what did she say? I just want to be sure people have the opportunity to talk about it and to do that in open court. It would be nice if she made a more positive statement, like, this is a ridiculous injunction, they have a right to be there, and I'm wondering what the hell the city is doing. But I guess that's me, not her. It's too bad, though. I think someone needs to say that on the city council. Stevens' decision didn't impress Mayor Mike Rotkin, who suggested the judge, get this, didn't understand the human element of the issue. If he had to pick up the human waste at City Hall, he might have a different view, said Rotkin. Real human beings are responsible for picking up after them, the protesters. Now, this statement is interesting for a number of reasons. First, it seems to imply that the protesters maybe aren't real human beings. Second, it states the protesters don't pick up after themselves, which isn't true. Dan Hopkins is always running around with a broom, picking up after everybody in town, not just the protesters. And thirdly, he ducks the issue, as he always does, of how he could solve this problem by opening up a bathroom. He's not addressed this, although it's been repeatedly raised. One of the comments that has been made by him, or by someone, I'm not sure if it was him, is that there is vandalism if the bathrooms are opened up. Well, you know, it's half a dozen to one and six of the other, but you can open it up in such a way that one person has the key and takes responsibility for it, and so forth. That hasn't been done. That hasn't been proposed. We've offered to do it. That is to say, Dan Hopkins has offered to do it. The protesters have offered to do it. I've been present when such offers were made. It's not being allowed. Instead, he prefers to use the shit issue to smear and stink up the protesters as some sort of unsanitary group, when the real criminals are the people who are allowing these conditions to develop by not making adequate facilities available. And while we're at it, not making adequate facilities available at night. The downtown parking garage restrooms should be open at night. They're not. Get on it, Mike. Rotkin said Stevens' restraining order admonishing protesters not to relieve themselves on the grounds doesn't carry much weight because it's difficult to catch them in the act. Well, Mike, maybe you should, you know, hop outside with your flashlight at midnight and, you know, do some investigating. That's why the city officials wanted the overnight ban. So rather than open a 24-hour restroom, they're prepared to close off City Hall to protesters. Well, Stevens didn't buy this, to his credit. Unfortunately, he's probably one of the few judges who would not simply bend over for this city nonsense that's being presented. Protesters, however, deny that anyone is using the City Hall grounds as an open toilet. They're fabricating facts, protest leader Daniel Hopkins said before the judge's decision. They're getting very close to stepping on our constitutional rights, says Dan with footprints all over his face, I might add. Dan's a very polite, gentle kind of guy and doesn't like to raise his voice on these issues, but he certainly has put his body down there. Hopkins said he had asked city officials to give him a key to the public restrooms across from council chamber. He said he promised to let only protesters use the bathroom and he would make sure there was no damage, but they refused. Well, Karen Clark gets that in. Good for her. Hopkins also said that the complaints of littering, illegal signs, and noise were overblown and simply an attempt to stop the protest. Not mentioned here is that there have been no citations for any of those actions, at least until yesterday morning, when police came, directed Pat Ring to sit down where he was smoking his cigarette, told him to put out his cigarette, and when he put it out on the ground, they gave him a ticket for littering. So that was the first littering ticket given at the protest. Actually, a sort of a police-directed littering ticket. Interesting. Santa Cruz attorney Kate Wells, who also appeared in court Wednesday in defense of the homeless camper, said the city's attempt to quell a protest should open the door to a legal challenge of the long-standing camping ordinance. That ordinance prohibits people from sleeping out of doors or covering up with bedding within the city limits. The protesters have occupied the city hall grounds in an effort to force officials to provide a safe place for homeless people to sleep outside legally. There are two errors in that sentence. They haven't occupied the grounds. They are on the grounds. They are in no way denying anyone else the free use of those grounds, nor are they in any way detracting from those grounds unless you just don't like the sight of protesters there. Secondly, they're not asking the city to provide a safe place for homeless people to sleep outside legally. They're asking that homeless people be allowed themselves to sleep unless there are other health and safety problems, simply because that is a human necessity for mammals, and might say for human beings. That is something they have to do, sleep, and something that they, we would presume, have a right to do, regardless of their economic status, sleep at night. So that, unfortunately, is a distortion or an omission, or a little of both, by Karen Clark. Beauvais said, because this is a case where sleeping has become an expressive conduct, the issue could become a First Amendment challenge. If that happens, he said, it would be a first. Apparently that tickled Karen Clark's fancy. She was interested in that. That's the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the May 23rd story, Santa Cruz City Hall campers win round in court. Considerably better than the earlier story, Santa Cruz lowers legal boom on squatters. Litter human waste at City Hall. I'm not even going to bother to read that story because Becky Johnson did a very good job tearing it apart in an editorial, which, surprisingly enough, the Santa Cruz Sentinel printed 4 days after the story, partially because I think it was breaking news, partially because we had a delegation of 9 people who went and essentially planted ourselves in the lobby of the Sentinel to talk to Karen Clark, and we spent about 20 minutes, Pat Ring, Becky Johnson, and I, playing good cop, bad cop with Karen Clark and trying to get her some of the facts, give her the information, and so forth. So the Sentinel is always a disappointment, and that's no news. There are some interesting stories in some other papers which haven't even reached San Francisco activist ears, at least. I found this out when I interviewed Keith McHenry this morning. I don't think we're going to have time to play that interview. There's a story in the Tuesday Examiner, May 21st, headlines, actually, no, it's front page, it's not headlines, it's Pepper Spray Study is Tainted, is the headline. And the secondary headline, Industry Paid Off FBI Agent Who Did the Research. The writer, Jim Heron Zamora. And here's the story. The main study cited by law enforcement agencies to support using pepper gas is tainted by a conflict of interest on the part of an FBI agent who conducted the research. The pepper spray study was conducted in the late 1980s by FBI Special Agent Thomas W.W. Ward at the FBI agency in Virginia outside Washington, D.C. But Ward did not disclose at the time that he had accepted $57,000 from a pepper spray manufacturer that was laundered through a Florida company owned by his wife, Sherry. On Friday, Ward was sentenced to 2 months in federal prison after he had earlier pleaded guilty to federal charges of accepting an illegal gift. Prosecutors said his short sentence reflected his cooperation with the FBI investigation. 2 months, that's how much I'm going to be spending in jail for serving free food. Interesting. Maybe I'll meet him there. The FBI fired Ward for not disclosing a financial conflict of interest. That's sort of a nice way of saying, graft? Based on Ward's research and testing, the FBI decided to buy the chemical product Cap-Stun, whose active ingredient, oleoresin capsicum, is derived from cayenne pepper. The spray is intended to temporarily incapacitate aggressive people by burning their skin and eyes and inflaming their respiratory passages, making breathing painful and difficult. Critics of pepper spray say the FBI research has been discredited and are calling for further studies. But Bay Area law enforcement agencies, including San Francisco, have no plans to quit using it. The San Francisco Police Department faces 2 lawsuits alleging that pepper spray may have led to the death of 2 suspects, Mark Garcia and Aaron Williams, against whom police used the spray repeatedly during struggles. The king has no clothes. I think law enforcement authorities were duped by a chemical company who wanted to sell their product, said Frederick Remmer, an attorney who represents the family of Garcia, who died April 7th after he was sprayed during an arrest by San Francisco police. They approved it as fast as they could. I think they have a real problem in San Francisco and across the nation. Under fire from the public and civil rights advocates, San Francisco Police Commission recently re-examined pepper spray, voting to go on using it. Last month, San Francisco's district attorney forbade his investigators to carry the spray, even though they have never used it. Reamer said local law enforcement officials across the country were quick to add pepper spray to their arsenals after Ward stood behind it. He was very instrumental in getting this approved around the nation, Reamer said. Once the feds approved this, local law enforcement followed like a bunch of puppies. Ward trained FBI agents and other law enforcers in the use of oleoresin capsicum products, including CapStun. Ward, then a leader in the FBI's firearms training unit, lectured extensively on pepper spray use. Prosecutors said that from December 1989 through 1990, Ward received about $5,000 a month for a total of $57,500 from Lucky Police Products, a Fort Lauderdale, Florida-based company that produced and sold the spray. In California, films used by the State Department of Justice to teach local law enforcement agencies about pepper spray quoted Ward and contained footage from an FBI exercise he had overseen. In 1992, State Attorney General Dan Lundgren promised mandatory safety studies when he authorized provisional use of the spray in California. The ACLU maintains that the required research has not been done. It's our position that the FBI work has tainted everything that followed it. It laid a foundation of sand under a house of cards, said Alan Pericini. That's Pericini, the American Civil Liberties Union's expert on pepper spray. Most police agencies don't recognize how dicey this situation is. San Francisco obviously has a serious training deficit on pepper spray. There are some policy and training issues for which the chickens are now coming home to roost. But San Francisco police point to other studies that support the spray as a safe and effective police tool, including research by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. The association studied 22 in-custody deaths involving pepper spray during 1990 to 93 and determined that none of the deaths was due to pepper spray, but were instead caused by positional asphyxiation, according to Deputy Chief Rich Holder of the San Francisco Police Department. Positional asphyxiation is, in effect, suffocation caused when the position of the body hinders breathing. What a coincidence! 22 people died because they were asphyxiated because of positional asphyxiation. A finding by Deputy Chief Rich Holder, who, by the way, is one of the chief antagonists to Food Not Bombs and supporters of the San Francisco Matrix program. That's a little aside by me. We're reading an article in the San Francisco Examiner, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. No phones in the studio to call in, but we invite you to continue to listen in and call in after the show if you have comments, or even now, to 423-4833, and we'll put your comments on the air later. We're not relying on Ward's tests, Holder said. We've looked at that issue, but also at other sources of testing. We have seen thousands of contacts where pepper was used and no conclusive deaths. Just in California, there were 23,000 uses of pepper spray with no documented deaths. That's why we came to this decision. The State Environmental Protection Agency had warned the State Department of Justice for at least 2 years about its safety concerns about the spray. However, plans to conduct extensive tests on it were never funded. In January, a new state law took effect that deregulated use of pepper spray. Law enforcement authorities are no longer required to, quote, research its effects. Instead, questions over pepper spray's effects appear to be moving from the lab to the courthouse. In addition to San Francisco, lawsuits regarding its use by police have been filed in several California counties, including Los Angeles. More people are going to die, said Reamer, who plans to file a wrongful death suit on behalf of Garcia's family. More police are going to get sued, and there is going to be a lot more money coming out of police officers. San Francisco police do not use CapStun, but instead use a similar product named First Defense, a milder form of pepper spray produced by the Defense Technology Corporation of Wyoming. An aside here, we might want to ask the hosts what their folks are carrying. You see, you may remember back in February, I think it was February, D-Bob, a Food Not Bombs volunteer, was pepper sprayed by host John Behrens. When later confronted on this issue as to whether he was still carrying pepper spray, Behrens refused to say he was not. So I understand that pepper spray is still being carried by at least some of the hosts in their hospitality program downtown, recently expanded by city council appropriation to include 5 instead of the 4 members. a program, by the way, which was initiated under false pretenses as some kind of non-police-oriented program, when in fact these men and women are little snitches running around enforcing class legislation on them all, masquerading as friendly tourist helpers. We can see who they're helping. Actually, they're not really helping anybody. I don't think this situation really helps the downtown businesses. Continuing the story on pepper spray in the San Francisco Chronicle of May 23rd. I think that's what it is anyway. Defense Technology has been sued by Lynn Williams, widow of Aaron Williams, a burglary suspect who died in police custody at age 35 in June after a conflict with officers in which he was sprayed. The ACLU says 37 people have died in California after being hit with pepper spray since January 1993. Most recently, a Ventura County man died on May 8th after he was sprayed. Pepper spray is being used at the rate of once an hour, and people are dying at the hands of law enforcement at the rate of once a month, said ACLU attorney John Crew, who monitors San Francisco police. We're not calling for a complete ban on its use, his colleague Pericini adds, but there are clearly serious problems that we see coming out. This can create a lot of liability for police agencies. We would like to see a lot more research on this product and a lot more research on alternative methods for police to safely subdue troublesome suspects. Police Commissioner Clotilde Hewlett concedes that many people are scared of the spray, but she supports its continued use. We have to keep looking at less deadly forms of force than the firearm, she said, but you have to look at the alternatives. When you take away pepper spray, you are removing a less lethal form of force. This leaves police with batons and firearms. It isn't perfect, but they need the spray as an option. And that, as I said, was the San Francisco Examiner. I'm not May 23rd, as I said a moment ago, but it's May 21st, Tuesday, the national edition of the San Francisco Examiner. Serious stuff, and I think that it would be interesting to find out just whether we know our police department is using pepper spray. They used it against activist David Dumars, also known as BD, back in 1994 when he was supporting a homeless protest. That was Sergeant Goofy Aloofy, as I call him, the Santa Cruz police sergeant who sprayed him from a distance of 4 inches and then, by BD's report, refused to allow him to wash his eyes out. Really, it's a serious situation. I wonder if the Santa Cruz Citizens Police Review Board, let's all have a cheer, might take a look into this topic. I would suggest that folks concerned about this issue call the Citizens Police Review Board, listed in the phone book. I believe the number, I don't want to give you a false number on that. I don't have it with me here. It is listed under Citizens Police Review Board in the white pages in the government section of the local phone book. Give them a call. Leave them a message and tell them this is something you want them to investigate. The board has recently undergone a change of personnel. Citizens Police Review Board member John Malkin has left, and we have some new people. I don't know how they are, if there are any. If the past performance of the board is any indication, it is less than pathetic. It's scandalous how this board refuses to support any kind of serious inquiry into the police department. They have not allowed one public hearing of any complaints, though they have that power to have a public hearing. They have refused my repeated requests to have public hearings on these issues, though they, again, could do that if they wanted. So, let's take a break with a little music from the Mime Troupe.
And lived in here. Your people's blood has fertilized this land for many years.
The rose from bullet workers sweat from years of slavery. Today we'll plant a field of bombs and set this pueblo free.
Vamos ya a hacer la bomba popular. Si hay que defender la tierra, voy a construir una bella bomba. Voy a esta arma de liberación. Yo lo hago de mi corazón.
Acérquense, compañeros, set up close and lend a hand. Put 50 grams of gunpowder very carefully in a can.
Pack in rocks for shrapnel, the fuse of rope will serve us well. If the warrior comes to take our land,
y lo hago de mi corazón.
Mime Troupe. Here's a little bit of a brief interview after a free radio meeting several weeks ago. There's been a lot of controversy around the Cannabis Club versus the Free Radio Collective when Free Radio was still in the same area as the Cannabis Club. There's also been critics of the current Cannabis Club who had some concerns about about the current Cannabis Club's operation. I guess there are a number of Cannabis Clubs. I'm referring to the one down on Maple Street. I guess it's hell is the name of it. I'm always getting these names wrong. It's the big one in town. And I'm giving a little airtime here to one of the critics of that club, and I invite anybody from the Cannabis Club who wants to respond. That, of course, is always my policy.
Chip, who has some very pungent criticisms about the current Cannabis Collective. Here we're ending a free Radio Santa Cruz meeting, and Chip, you're making some strong allegations here. And those allegations are that the Cannabis Collective is selling weed for money to people who need it, and that's an improper practice.
Yes. Starting around 1990 in Santa Cruz, a collective was formed totally underground to provide marijuana for those folks who needed it for medical use. It was free of charge. We got contributions from various growers and dealers, so-called, of this herb that grows on the planet, which is controlled by the man. In about 1994, some people from various localities came together with money from Dennis Perrone, who's the person who runs the Medical Marijuana Collective in San Francisco. They immediately took over the whole program in a very serious effort to eliminate those folks who were doing this for free. Eagle, so I'd prefer not to use anybody's names.
And
maybe,
I'm sorry.
Maybe you could edit that out,
right.
Robert.
Okay.
The fact is, though, that they are selling it for the same price as just about anybody in Santa Cruz is selling. An eighth of an ounce of the kind cost about $60-$70. Now, that's absurd. If you believe that you want to help people, you don't make a profit. And they are making a profit. They don't need to make a profit. They don't need an office. They don't need a club. There's plenty of us who will provide safe haven for those who need to smoke it somewhere other than their home. There's plenty of us who are willing to provide transportation of this medicine to people who are unable to leave their home. Nobody needs to make any money on it. As long as they're making money on it, those of us in the community who are willing to do this without money will be fighting against them. They're definitely something weird, and when somebody who's supposed to be their security doesn't even have the ability to control his drinking and his violent behavior, the community needs to deal with it. And the best way is to ostracize him.
Now, are you coming to this meeting at Ed Fry's at, I guess, at 7 or 7.30 on Wednesday?
I would love to come to this meeting. I can't. I teach a class at that time, but I will hopefully tell other people that will be at the meeting, because the community can provide an alternative to this particular program.
Is it 7
program.
Or 7.30? Do you remember?
It's 7.30 at Ed Fry's office.
201 Maple Street.
Maple Street and Cedar.
With the idea
and
of forming a new cannabis collective.
Yes, I would encourage anyone who would in the community with either point of view, whether they're for it or against it, should come to this meeting, because only...
I'm interrupting the interview briefly to note that the meeting didn't happen,
And as I understand it, as of now, the meeting is, there's still ongoing criticism of the Cannabis Club, and there may indeed be ongoing efforts to form a second group, but it's not happening around Ed Frey's office at the moment, as far as I know. There is no meeting on Wednesday. This is an old tape anyway, but I was trying to give you some indication of the kind of controversy and concern that's going on. And I, again, invite anyone from the Cannabis Club to respond to these concerns specifically, and I will probably invite them more directly when there's more time on the tape. We have more time in the studio, and we actually have the possibility of live guests. We actually did have the possibility of live guests today. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. As you know, we have no call-in number at the moment, but if you, we do have a message phone. That's not a Free Radio message phone. It's my message phone, a HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And you can leave me a message at 423-4833. A couple of brief updates. The most crucial thing that is happening over the weekend is preparing for the preliminary injunction for the City Hall sleepers, as far as I'm concerned. There is a Tuesday deadline to file papers, to file declarations. Those are the statements by individuals who've come to the City Hall sleepout and can testify that they don't see piles of shit all over, that they haven't seen or taken a piss on the City Hall areas. Actually, that is becoming a secondary topic. The real topics have to do with blocking walkways. I have come to the, and intend to declare that I've come to the City Hall sleepout many times, and I've never seen people blocking walkways in such a way as to stop people from walking by. That's just a lie that is being put forward as a basis for barring people from City Hall. The signs have been reasonably...
Hello, boys and girls. This is your old pal, Stinky Whistletee.
Finally made our way down to the studio. This is Bathrobes Pier Robert Norris. Only 7 minutes late on May 24th, 1996. You're tuned to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. The alternative to the alternative. It's Friday, and this is Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides is civil rights in Santa Cruz, particularly for poor people. But we kind of range around. We are going to go up to Eureka today. We're going to go to San Francisco.